And in the studio, I've actually got a live guest, which is very exciting at this time of morning. G'day, Judith Peppard. How are you?
Thanks, Annie. And it is very exciting and to be here too. But also, I think it's amazing that you come in on Saturday mornings and provide.
Yeah. More cheer, more accolades.
Yeah, let's have them. Bring them on.
it's a bit like that thing where they say, oh, someone's a hero because they're doing their job.
Well, look, I mean, thank you for inviting me and also for the introduction. And yes, I was at the 27th Harm Reduction International Conference, which was held in Melbourne this month. I think it was the 16th and 19th, around that time, mid-month. And look, just to frame the next conversation, I just wanted to say a bit about some of the things discussed at the conference. So, first of all, you know, I'm sure you remember Helen Clark, former Prime Minister of New Zealand.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, she's now the chair. I mean, she's done a lot of work in the UN since then, but she's currently the chair of the Global Commission on Drug Policy.
Ah, yeah, cool.
And she opened the conference with a very powerful call to decriminalize and regulate all drugs.
Yeah.
So that kind of set the perspective for the conference. And she pointed out that, you know, first of all, and I think we all know this, drug prohibition has been a costly failure, and that doesn't even get to, you know, that's the cost.
Well, it's a costly failure for society and people within it.
Yes.
But it's obviously got a purpose and a framework for finance and power brokers.
Indeed, yes. And in terms of the failure part, she pointed out that there's some and first of all, you know, the idea is we're going to have a drug-free world, which is a nonsense. Let's face it.
No, humans are quite attracted to drugs.
Yeah, and we go back to tradition. I mean, in the conference, it was interesting because there's quite a few presentations about traditional use, you know, traditional cultures, First Nations people's use of various drugs, and in some cases also regulated.
Yeah, and also interesting, like everything, on one side, you've got the deserving drugs. On the other side, you've got the undeserving drugs.
Yes. In fact, one of the presenters said there's an apartheid, a presenter from South Africa, there's an apartheid around drugs. So, you know, you and I can go down to the pub. But if you and I decide to have a drug that's illegal, then, you know, we're treated incredibly differently. So, yes, so absolutely, that's the case. And she said, so it was set up, you know, to stop all drug use, which was a nonsense to start with. But illicit drug use is growing globally. So that didn't work.
Well, considering that people are extremely anxious and extremely poor.
yes, indeed. You know, and the illicit drug production is increasing to meet the need.
It is an industry.
It is an industry. And but I think and closer to home and what we're speaking about today, punitive drug laws are a major driver of incarceration. She said an estimated 2.2 million worldwide in prison for drug offences.
Say that again.
What's that?
Say that number.
I'll say that again. And it is an estimate, but they've done the research and they're in a position to know, so I expect it's pretty close. 2.2 million people worldwide in prison for drug offenses, and 22% of those for drug possession for personal use.
Oh, that's awful.
So this was, you know, this kind of set the framework. And of course, as we know, and it's really brought home today for us, that in some countries, people are put to death for drug offenses. And we heard two very moving presentations from people from Singapore and from Indonesia about the death penalty. And these were from people who are working to end it in both of those countries. And, of course, Australia has been affected too. We've set up a medically supervised injecting centre to prevent overdose deaths, for example. And, you know.
And there's been increases. There's been not because of the. It was a response to the spike in deaths by overdose.
That's right. And the evaluations have proven positive. So this is good news. And also we need to look more at that and perhaps, and another one, I think. Yeah. So you know, whether you're in Singapore, Indonesia, or here in Australia, the fact that these drugs are illegal contributes to drug-related to death. But anyway, today, and I just want listeners to know, because this is a sad story, today is the anniversary of the day that Andrew Chan and Muran Sukumaran were executed in Indonesia. It was on April 29th, 2015, and for trafficking in drugs. And the term traffic I put in quotes because what does that mean? And often it's small, you know, people who aren't wealthy. They're often not well educated. In some cases in Singapore, it was reported some were even illiterate and didn't even know what they're getting into. But anyway, today is a sad day because of the death of two people who we all knew about through the media, and there were huge protests against these executions here in Australia, and Indonesia people worked to prevent it. And so there was an outcry, but the executions went ahead. So Andrew Chan and Muran Sukumaran were arrested in Bali in 2005 for recruiting seven people to smuggle heroin from Indonesia into Australia. And the group became known as the Bali Nine, of course, in the press. Seven received prison sentences, but Andrew and Muran were seen as ringleaders, were depicted in that way, and were sentenced to death. So last week I spoke with Belinda Lewis and Jeff Lewis, independent academics working in cultural studies, anthropology, public health, and they were working in Indonesia. They've done a lot of research in Indonesia, and they were working there at the time and contributed, as many people did, to trying to have the death penalty not applied. So they were deeply distressed when they heard the news of the executions. Here's Belinda Lewis.
We were in Australia, but we were very well aware of the situation. And that next morning was a very quiet, somber, and attached to quite a lot of sorrow.
We knew it was coming because they'd been moved to the island, and we knew how the execution was going to take place. So it was all there fixed in our minds and imaginary. So when we got the news, which was the next morning for us, no one knew it was going to actually happen that night. At the time, it's even more emotionally disturbing and distressing. Execute them by firing squad. They don't know which ones have live ammunition and which ones don't. So there's a whole group of them. They don't know who does the actual killing. That's to protect the emotions of the execution squad. They know they were getting a lot of international condemnation for it, not just from Australia, but from around the world. And they were keeping it as secretive as possible.
So we had an approximate sense of when it all might take place, but for that reason, it was very much done in secret.
How did you become involved in the campaign to prevent the execution?
We'd been working and going into the prison since around about 2002, did a 10-year immersion study of the impacts of the bombings on local communities and people in Bali and Indonesia. And we were concerned about the welfare and conditions that prisoners during the crisis that followed. We'd been going in, particularly speaking to Australian prisoners and performing some support roles with Chappelle Forby. And then not long after, the Bali Nine were apprehended and brought in altogether. We began a support relationship, bringing necessities, speaking with family members, speaking with any of the prisoners who felt they wanted that companionship and support.
I think it's fair to say we, pretty early on, we crossed the line between being pure researchers to being supporters. We went in there to do research basically on Indonesia's social systems and support networks and health systems. And our first interest was actually looking at the way sex workers were being treated and being marshalled through the prison system. And then, of course, a lot of the sex workers were associated with some sort of petty drug taking. It wasn't a big deal, but it all blew up with the arrest of some of the internationals, the Nigerians in particular, a couple of Brazilians, and then the Australians. So we were there when Bali Nine were brought into the prison. We were already doing some work. And because they were Australian, we felt that level of affinity and we could speak their language comfortably. We saw exactly what it all meant. We've got experience of the prison system in Australia as well. And we understand who it is that gets incarcerated, who it is that gets convicted. We understand very clearly. So we were concerned, and then it became a personal thing for us because we became friendly with quite a few of them.
And their families. Some of our work was just in that day-to-day conversation in passing. Some of it was behind the scenes doing formal academic writing about the death penalty. A lot of it was liaising with various media. In Bali, we've quite high-profile people in Indonesia, the governor of Pastika at the time and big media people. And wherever we had an opportunity to bring up this issue, we did.
Well, Pastika is actually a really interesting character in this story.
The governor.
Yeah, he was originally a senior police officer and he's actually on the narcotics board before he became governor of Bali. And he was one of the few people who did have a more compassionate view of drug traffic and drug taking, was one of the rare voices in Indonesia who was looking at it as much as a health issue as it was a criminal issue. So there are these voices in Indonesia who are supportive. Amnesty Indonesia has been very big on opposing the death penalty. But there are other people too, and there's been a review of the criminal code and just recently placed a new kind of condition on the death penalty. The new approach will be that a probationary death penalty, where you'll be given the death penalty, but it won't be enforced for 10 years. So you'll have 10 years if the judge decides to do this, give you this option. Amnesty Indonesia support it to a degree because it's better than what it is at the current stage, but they're all still concerned that it's left to the discretion of the judges in the case.
And some recognition, I think, that there is that decision-making rests on individuals and it's not enshrined firmly. And that's exactly what happened to both Andrew and Mayu. Given the death sentence and made their appeals and basically were refused by quite lower level members of the judiciary in a local district court. People are at the mercy of whoever is in position of power at the time, and that's really not enough. Andrew and Mayu were incredibly well regarded by the majority of people within the prison, and the prison governor had repeatedly made many, many calls of support on their behalf, which had no weight at all. So the description of what Amnesty Indonesia is talking about now is no matter how reformed or how positive prisoners are over that 10-year probationary period, it's still very, very, very up in the air as to whether or not this would be an effective tool for saving people's lives.
Belinda Lewis. And as Belinda has pointed out, there are people in Indonesia advocating against the death penalty and seeking drug law reform. But change is difficult, and keeping drugs criminalized is big business.
And it's a huge economy for which Australia, an Australian population, provides a huge market, a huge demand for these drugs.
It's really ironic, you know, because drug taking is rife in Indonesia. It's got a deep history. I mean, everything from, you know, the betel nut chewing to in the kampongs at night. Anytime you go to any of the kampongs, any of the neighbourhoods in Indonesia, you'll find them with this pot of stuff that they're stirring up and all imbibing. It's been like that since I can remember. I've been going there for 50 years almost. And there's always been these kind of social gatherings around some form of drug taking, which may include alcohol or various potions. What's happened in Indonesia is that the international tourist trade has brought a new kind of drug schemata into Indonesia. And that's when we've got the party drugs, and which are much more rife and more replete than heroin. But then we've also got heroin. The other ironical thing is that Bali Nine were actually trying to get drugs out of Indonesia, not bring them in. So you could decriminalize drug taking, as you should decriminalize drug taking probably everywhere, not just in Indonesia.
Everybody working in this field agrees that when it's prohibited, it's expensive. And when there's a lot of profit to be made, there is a lot of crime involvement.
Can I add a footnote, though, about the death of Ayer? Because when Amrozi was executed, he was the ringleader of the Bali bombings. When Amrozi was executed, we were put under us on the spot. But we were asked, well, do you oppose the death penalty for someone like Amrozi? Why aren't you advocating on his behalf? Well, we actually were. We actually did write to say, no, the death penalty, even for someone like Amrozi, should not be prosecuted. You should not use the death penalty in these circumstances. And the reason being is that the state should be better than that. That's my view, that the state should be better than having to resort to something like the death penalty in order to manage the criminal process, in order to manage criminality. The people whom we got to know, and most of them were the Australians, but others as well. We got to know some of the Nigerians and some of the other people, Indonesians. The savagery of the place leaves people intellectually, mentally destitute. It's just so brutal, so cruel, so austere. You know, you'll have 12 women, men crushed into this small space. They sleep on the floor, toilet in the corner. Sanitation's awful, the health's awful. Part of our support process in the prisons was actually bringing food in. We just bring food in because their food rations were so poor.
And unhygiene, a lot of sickness. Accompanying that is a sense of responsibility to these families. I couldn't call it necessarily ongoing reparation, but particularly around the Bali Nine, because it was a bungle. It was a bungled attempt to smuggle the drugs, but it was a bungle because the AFP were tipped off many weeks prior to this crime even being commenced. They were notified and those Australians weren't protected in any shape or form. In fact, those families need a huge amount of support right now. The flow-on effects have been horrific. All of them, all of their contacts, and no responsibility really has been taken for that.
Yeah, and look, the other thing about being incarcerated in the prison system, whether it's in Australia or in Indonesia, is that they're really brutal places. They are violent places. So there's a lot of actual crime within the prison system itself, a lot of hierarchy and violence, and that has connections to the outside world, criminal gangs in Indonesia. So there's a whole economy within the prison system itself. There's also drug taking is rife in the prison system, as it is here, but it's even worse over there. And drugs are become a commodity, become the money, become the currency in the prison system.
And sometimes there's a choice between the drug that you need and that you're dependent on and food or access to medicines.
What does this experience tell you about the international prohibition regime?
I think it just fortifies what we already know and what we've known for a very, very long time. It simply tells us that treating drug taking as a criminal process, criminal activity, is misguided. It's totally misguided. And there are plenty of people on all sides of politics in Indonesia. They recognize that the war on drugs, their war on drugs, isn't working. They know it's not working. Unfortunately, they are subject to a process of election in which crime and criminality becomes a useful popularity tool. Jokowi, he was being pressured by his own party to show what a tough guy he was. It shows you that the international system on drug prohibition, treating drugs as a criminal issue rather than a health issue or a social issue, is just completely misguided, completely misguided.
You're back with Annie on Solidarity Breakfast, and we've got Judith Peppard in the studio. That was a fairly sobering report, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And I think if people who were hearing, particularly who have been connected around those executions, are struggling and finding and they're distressed, it's important to speak with someone, and you can call Lifeline on 131114. But I thought, you know, in his final statement there, Jeff Lewis, talking about the death penalty and the futility of the war on drugs. And I think that you know, it starts at the top from the UN, and which, again, influenced by the US around that. And, you know, in 1961, the single convention was introduced, which, you know, transmitted this prohibition policy to the UN, to the whole world. And of course, Belinda Lewis then also talked about how making drugs illegal raises the price and opens the way for black market, for crime, criminal. And of course, that's what happened in America during Prohibition in the 20s, you know. And then they take a failed policy and let's, you know, apply it to cannabis. Let's apply it to other drugs, heroin, for example, and then bring it to the world. And we have the kind of distress, you know, what we've seen happen. So I want to thank Belinda Lewis and Jeff Lewis for their time, because as you would have heard at the beginning, I think they both were, you know, very, it was an emotional time for them too, and quite distressed when they heard about those executions and also involved in the process. They were clear with me that, you know, they weren't the only people.
Oh, yeah.
Many, many people. And even the Australia, I think, huge protests coming from the top, from the federal government.
You were saying that this is not an abandoned policy. When you came in, you were saying that you were quite amazed at a recent execution in Singapore.
Yes, well, last week, Wednesday, I think it was, we heard that another person has been executed in Singapore. And despite pleas for clemency from his family and protests from activists, and that the prosecutor's evidence was weak, they were arguing the evidence was weak for this particular execution. And this was reported on the ABC as well. And I found it interesting that one of the people they quoted was Kristen Hahn, who presented at the Harm Reduction Conference about the death penalty. And she's part of the Transformative Justice Collective in Singapore. And she's a journalist, and she's wanting to get the message out that this is not a good way to deal with drug policy. It's time to ban it. And I think one of the things that Belinda Lewis said was the fact that Australia is a huge market. And while these drugs are illegal, we provide a market.
Well, it's very sobering that that fellow, was it a fellow? That was executed?
Yeah, it was a man. I'm sorry, I didn't write his name down.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. But he was convicted of, what was it?
A kilogram of cannabis. So he was executed for bringing I've only really caught up with the story, so more to find out there, and I'm sure more will emerge. But I think if you have over 500 grams in Singapore, you could be subject to the death penalty.
Thanks for coming in and talking to us this morning, Judith.
It's been a pleasure, Annie. Thanks for inviting me.